Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I just want to state that, as you probably have noticed, the stock market hit an all-time record high today, over 22,000.
First of all, it was the Dow Jones Industrial Average at 22,000, not the whole stock market. But that's petty, I know. Number two, though, the Dow is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow. That is very real. Number three, and more to the point, stocks aren't even the right market to be watching. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 2nd of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Look, I get it. Really, I do. It's easy to get distracted by the bright, shiny object that is the Dow. But not for the first time, I would urge you to look away because there are other, better, actual market indicators that can give you a more real sense of what's going on out there. Bonds we talk about from time to time. Also, today, the foreign exchange markets, currency, the dollar in particular, because as the Dow has been rising, the greenback has been tumbling down 10% against a basket of currencies since January. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra starts us off.
When President Trump was elected, he promised to boost economic growth by rolling back regulation, cutting taxes, and fixing the country's infrastructure. Investors responded by betting on the U.S., buying dollars. The dollar's value jumped. But fast forward to 2017.
What you've seen in the last 6 months is a retreat of the dollar against other currencies.
Lisa Cook, who teaches economics at Michigan State, says investors have watched those plans stall in Washington. They've lost confidence, and they're dumping the dollar.
They're having second thoughts.
A weaker dollar can be a bad thing. It makes it more expensive to go on vacation to Paris or buy an imported car. But Jack McIntyre, a portfolio manager at Brandywine Global, says the dollar's fall has an upside.
I think a lot of people are actually applauding the weaker dollar. The administration, the corporate sector.
When the dollar's worth less, it's cheaper for people in other countries to buy things from American manufacturers like Boeing and Apple. And Gad Levinon, an economist at the Conference Board, says there's another reason American companies with foreign operations are cheering. They earn money in the local currency, euros, pounds, yen.
So profits that are generated in the rest of the world are now valued more in dollar terms.
Levinon says the falling dollar has already boosted corporate profits in the U.S. It may also be one of the reasons the Dow is hitting those all-time highs. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
There's an element of this next story in which Donald Trump is acting just like all of his recent predecessors. It's been widely reported and not disputed by the White House that the administration is going to go after China for unfair trade practices sometime soon, specifically about IP, intellectual property. That's practically bipartisan Washington and corporate America boilerplate complaining about Chinese companies making their own inevitably cheaper knockoffs of American stuff. But as Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains, there is also a part of this story in which President Trump is going his own way.
When I was in second grade, I thought of this great joke, which I then told my classmate Chris. Then he went around telling everyone else my joke, claiming he made it up. Chad Bone of the Peterson Institute says that's basically what China is up to.
I think that's a apt analogy, yeah.
This has been happening for years. If you want to sell fancy watches in China, say, you often can't just make them here and ship them over. You have to create a joint venture where you share the instructions with a Chinese company.
And, you know, the partner in the joint venture gets access to your intellectual property.
And they can set up their own factory, make their own fancy watches, and cut you out. The standard way to fight this is via formal complaint to the World Trade Organization. But Hal Shapiro of the law firm Akin Gump says companies can be reluctant to go to trial.
It's like being hacked. You don't necessarily want the world to know you've been hacked, and you may be angering a very important customer in the Chinese market.
The White House is said to be planning to go around the WTO and start its own investigation. Chad Bone of the Peterson Institute says that if we impose trade sanctions on China without the WTO, it would be like confronting the schoolyard bully.
If you decided to chase this kid around the playground by yourself and hit him over the head with your lunchbox, as opposed to going to the principal and asking them to look into this matter for you.
Bone's fear is that taking matters into our own hands will shift the spotlight from what China is doing wrong to how we're behaving. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
As you might have heard, Dow 22K today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, is promising bipartisan hearings after Labor Day to see if Congress can't come to some kind of agreement on how to stabilize the individual health insurance market, the one most affected by the Affordable Care Act, and not coincidentally, also the one in the political crosshairs of congressional Republicans' most recent efforts to get rid of said act. Health insurance companies, along with people in that market, are in the economic crosshairs. Marilyn Tavener is the president and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans. That's a lobbying group for health insurance companies. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The hearings by Senator Alexander next month, first of all, I'm sure you are heartened by them. I wonder if you believe they're going to do any good in stabilizing the individual market.
Well, I am heartened by the fact that Senator Alexander is willing to hold hearings and that both Republicans and Democrats have expressed an interest and trying to deal with a short-term problem, which is the stabilization of the market.
The director of the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, was on CNN this morning. He said, you know what? We're going to talk about these payments on a month-to-month basis. That's what we've always said. What do you make of the injected uncertainty into the market?
Well, talking about the payments on a month-to-month basis does create uncertainty, and hopefully that is a short-term process. And Senator Alexander and others are willing to make a permanent appropriation for this funding.
Are you confident the president would sign that?
I wouldn't begin to say what the president would do, but we certainly would encourage him, and I think it would help if it were a permanent appropriation or at least an appropriation for 2018 and 2019.
What is the one thing you think could happen that would make your members feel more secure about getting into the individual market right now?
I think the one thing that could happen is some certainty around these CSR fundings or the subsidies for low-income people. Most of our members are in the individual market to serve consumers. And these consumers, about two-thirds of them, qualify for these low-income subsidies. And so the certainty around that funding would be extremely helpful to having folks settle down and be willing to stay in the market for the long term.
In preparation for our talk this morning, I went back and looked at some of the writings that you've done, letters to members of Congress and the president, all the way back to March the 8th of 2017. You were talking to Congress and the president about stability in the marketplace. I wonder your thoughts on the fact that we are still trying to hammer out some way to make the individual insurance market in this country work.
Well, I think that I have been talking about it even prior to March of this year.
Sure, yeah.
It seems like the entire time I've been at AHIP, I've been talking about this surety around funding. The message is pretty clear. We're talking about 10 million people. It shouldn't be that hard to solve this problem.
Can I ask you a more fundamental question, ma'am? And it goes like this. There is not very much in the Affordable Care Act or in any of the bills that Republicans in the Congress now have presented that go to the underlying issue, which is actually the cost of medical care in this country. What's it going to take to get at that, which I think you have to acknowledge is the bigger issue?
Well, I think that you recognize a very valid point. We would like to get to the issue of overall affordability. And as long as we are dealing with the individual market, I think we do avoid dealing with underlying medical costs, whether we're talking about actual medical care, cost of prescription drugs, inefficiency and waste in the system. Those are the bigger issues we'd like to tackle. So we would like to solve the individual market and move on.
Marilyn Tavener, she is the president and CEO of AHIP. Marilyn Tavener, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
The chaos in Venezuela continued today, the most recent development being confirmation from the company that made them that the voting machines used in the controversial election this past weekend had been tampered with. The Trump administration, as we told you yesterday, has imposed sanctions on President Nicolas Maduro and is threatening more. But as with all things economic, best beware the unintended consequences, because if Washington pushes hard enough, Venezuela could go belly up on its debt. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
This is complicated, but the key is that Venezuela is running out of money for food, for medicine, for paying off its debts. And investors in Wall Street are circling people who stand to make money in case of default. Harvard economist Ricardo Hausman is a former Venezuela planning minister.
The markets have been sort of like betting on, you know, will this last a month longer, a quarter longer? But the situation has been deteriorating dramatically.
The only sector that really makes money there is oil. So if the White House punishes or embargoes Venezuelan oil, it would speed up the country going broke and defaulting on debt payments. But here's the thing. Russia's state-owned company Rosneft has loaned a lot of money to Venezuelan energy companies, so it could take a big share of the oil business there. Same story potentially with China, says Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners.
The Trump administration has to ask whether they would be putting Venezuela on the best footing with both Russia and China controlling oil assets and making essentially Venezuela a client state.
Separately, U.S. sanctions could turn the Venezuelan masses anti-American and perhaps pro-China and Russia. Here's how Russ Dallant at Caracas Capital Markets sees the broad challenge for D.C.
They don't want to be seen as allowing another Cuba to grow in Latin America, whereas Cuba is just an insignificant little speck on an island. Venezuela is rich, rich, rich in oil, minerals, and other wealth.
A big test comes tomorrow, when a new assembly in Caracas that much of the world deems illegitimate holds its first meeting. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, we launched before it was even called Wi-Fi. It was still 802.11b. Which makes them real, real old in tech years. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 52 points today, 0.2%, 22,016 at the bell. The NASDAQ basically flat, 6,362. S&P 500 gained a point, also basically flat, 2,477. The Dow was lifted today by rallying shares of Apple, reported better-than-expected forecast for the September quarter, up 4.7%. Sony down 0.9%. Microsoft dialed down 0.4%. Today, Qatar Airways' attempt to buy a big stake in American Airlines is not going to get off the ground. After all, Qatar now says that investment, quote, no longer meets its objective. On that news, American, which never liked the idea and let it be known, down 0.1% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.27%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We were talking about the dollar earlier and how that can work out pretty well for economies using other currencies. Try the Eurozone. The latest set of figures from the European Commission show that as a whole, the 19 countries that use the euro, the single currency, are now growing faster than the United States is. The first time that has happened in many a year. Even Greece is looking a little bit more buoyant. So one can rightly ask, is the European debt crisis finally over? Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one from the European desk in London.
British traders once caused deep offence by labelling the five weakest Eurozone countries, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece and Spain, with the insulting acronym PIGS. Well, today those countries have their revenge. They've apparently defied the negative forecasts. The PIGS might not be flying yet, but, says analyst Laura Foll, they're certainly taking off.
Europe has actually had a very good year today and is genuinely recovering. You know, unemployment has come down, economic growth is looking better than expected.
Take Spain, heavily indebted and bailed out. It's now growing at more than 3% per year. Even the zone's financial pariah has come in out of the cold. For the first time in 3 years, Greece has put its bonds up for sale and was inundated with offers.
I was a bit surprised that it was oversubscribed. But this is surely a positive sign, yes.
Florian Henser, Europe economist with Germany's largest private bank, Berenberg, has been charting the rebound in the Eurozone economies.
We see a big improvement, especially in Ireland.
And?
Even Portugal is actually growing at a very healthy pace.
All this comes after 7 years of crisis, after $380 billion worth of bailout money has been pumped into Greece alone, and after the bailed-out countries were compelled to cut their public spending and reform their economies, largely at the insistence of the German government. Tough love, Hensa calls it.
So that tough love has certainly worked. They are reaping the benefits of those reforms and cuts.
Do you think the German government's been vindicated by this general improvement in the Eurozone now?
They probably have.
Not all economists are saluting the Germans, however. Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform says the austerity made matters worse in Greece, and he's unimpressed by that country's supposed improvement.
It's gone through the biggest peacetime slump of any developed economy ever, and it's yet to bounce back in any meaningful way.
Those Greek bonds sold out, he says, only because they offered, in a world starved of yield, a very high rate of interest. And he's not too impressed by the overall improvement in the Eurozone either.
That's very weak, given the scale of the preceding slump. So the Eurozone economy is only still a little bit bigger than it was pre-2007 crisis. There's a long, long, long way to go before people can start talking about recovery.
Hardened critics of the euro, like Henry Newman of the Open Europe think tank, say that despite the growth spurt in the zone, the deep existential flaws remain.
I can't personally imagine how you can have a currency sustainable in the long term across such disparate economies without having much more political union.
In other words, a United States of Europe, with Germany shouldering the debts of its poorer partners. That won't happen anytime soon, says German economist Florian Hensa.
Definitely the German government sees this as a red line currently.
And despite what he calls the gathering pace of the upswing in the Eurozone, he seems in two minds about the bloc's immediate future.
Do you think the Eurozone is out of the woods now? Is this the end of the Eurozone debt crisis?
Yes and no.
Now that's what I call an economist's forecast. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Ubiquitous and speedy Wi-Fi is pretty much an economic must-have. We all just take it for granted. But how often do you really think about where that Wi-Fi is coming from? Not all that often, right? Depending on where you are, though, Boingo Wireless is likely the provider, probably best known for Wi-Fi in airports, but that is a shrinking slice of its business. Boingo is today's conversation from the corner office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Dave Hagen is Boingo's CEO, and really, corner office is more of a metaphor today.
Yeah, so this is the lobby of Boingo headquarters, and you walk in, as you guys did this morning, and you see the Network Operations Center. So it's the heartbeat of the company, and it says what we do, right? We build, design, operate wireless networks in major venues.
Does it make you crazy that if I say Boingo to a lot of people, they're going to go, oh, man, those guys in the airports?
No, not at all. I actually get, are you go-go in the airplanes?
Oh, yeah, right.
And so I describe we're the fast guys in the airports. They're the slower guys in the airplanes.
That's a little bit of Wi-Fi shade right there.
Yeah, right. But I actually don't, because people know us as a brand from the airport experience. And most people now get online in airports with Boingo for free.
But it's interesting because that's not the core of your business now, is it?
It's about 20% of our business. Most people know us as that. That's how we built the brand, and we went from that strength and then went into a lot of different types of venues.
What I mean, when you say venues, what does that mean? Is that sports stadiums? Is it the Rose Bowl? Is it, what is it?
So it's major venues where you have a lot of people congregating, where cellular service typically is weak, largely because you have so many people trying to access a network. So airports, transportation hubs, sports arenas. We're in Soldier Field. We're in Phillips Arena in Atlanta. We're in military bases where cellular coverage is typically very poor for our soldiers. So we still are in the same business of building and operating Wi-Fi networks, but the monetization strategy around those networks has changed dramatically.
And the venue then pays you to do this, and that's how you're making your money.
So typically the venue will give us long-term rights. They may pay us to operate a network. The cellular carriers may pay us, and then we went into other types of venues, and we figured out other ways to monetize. So we have advertising. We have partners pay us for access. So another way to monetize that free network is American Express pays Boingo to their cardholder base. It's free.
It's funny, actually, now. Wi-Fi is basically supposed to be free. I mean, it just is.
It's certainly the expectation.
Does that make you crazy?
No, because we figured out how to monetize it.
You've been here 16 years, right?
I have, yeah.
What was it like in Wi-Fi land in 2001? Take us back there, would
you?
Yeah,
so no smartphones. Most PCs did not have a Wi-Fi chip inside. You actually had to go buy the $100
right, that thing you
card,
stuck in
the slot,
thing, yeah.
The big honking Wi-Fi card. So it was a very different business. I think our original retail plan, which now sells for $9.95 a month in the airports for subscription, I think it was $79.99.
Well, there's a thing on the wall over there, 2001. Boingo was born, $74.95.
There you go,
and you're
$74.95.
Like, are you kidding me, $75?
We were very proud of the service. But it was a different time, right? So being able to hold up your laptop, not have it connected to any no cords, no wires, but connected to the internet was mind-blowing. And again, we launched before Wi-Fi chips were in laptops. We launched before it was even called Wi-Fi. It was still 802.11b.
Wow.
Yeah. Sheesh. So it was a different time. Different time.
How much do you worry about the FCC and things like net neutrality and regulation of your industry?
Yeah, we try to stay out of that. We're neutral host. So we let
Come on, nobody's neutral about this.
Well, we're neutral host as a strategy, meaning we go to the venue and the venue's our partner. And then we bring the carriers onto those networks, right? So we let the big guys fight out those kind of issues. We try to stay neutral and in between. A company the size of Boingo playing in the world of the big four telecom carriers and the cable cos, we're not going to drive policy.
Well, so that's an interesting question, right? You have something, you serve like a billion people, right? That's not small.
Well, it's small in the context of the size companies that we both compete with and then partner with. You think about an AT&T, a Verizon, right, a Charter, cable. Yeah. I mean, these are huge companies compared to us.
Look out another 15 years for me. In other words, basically as long as you've been at this company, and let's say you stick around another 15 years, what does this space look like?
So the device, I think, is going to change pretty dramatically. I think the phone, you know, the smartphone, where could this possibly go? It's unbelievable, right? It's a supercomputer in our hand. And I think that's going to get distributed. So you're already seeing a little bit with the Apple Watch, right? Now you see wearables. Our CTO has a chip embedded into his wrist.
Really?
Yeah. So when he comes into the parking lot, he hangs out his hand and it opens the gate to the ground.
We have to go track him down. Man.
Yeah, and this probably a little scary for folks, but it's actually very natural, is all that capability in the smartphone is going to start getting distributed. So that may mean it's distributed in other elements, other devices that we carry. I think it's also going to be distributed within us.
Within us, within us.
Within us, yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And it's going to be amazing.
The reason I recoil at that question is I've got a 10-year-old daughter, and she says, Dad, when do I get a cell phone? And I say, sweetie, by the time you're ready for a cell phone, it's just going to be in a chip in our brains.
See?
And that's basically what you're saying.
Right? You've seen the future.
There we go.
Dave Hagan there. He's the CEO of Boingo Wireless at their offices out on the west side of L.A. We've got the rest of the conversation, including what it was like to be in the Wi-Fi business when the iPhone came along, on our Corner Office podcast. I should tell you, we tried to find the CTO, the one with the chip in his wrist. He wasn't around. This final note on the way out today, a callback to where we started, Donald Trump talking about the stock market. Here he is again.
Now, look, we have the worst revival of an economy since the Great Depression. And believe me, we're in a bubble right now. And the only thing that looks good is the stock market. But if you raise interest rates even a little bit, that's going to come crashing down. We are in a big, fat, ugly bubble.
All right, full disclosure, that was last year, then candidate Trump on September the 27th, 2016, when the Dow closed at 18,228, or almost 21% below where it closed today. All right, we got to go. But listen, just because I'm always talking about context and how important it is fair here. Let me play you the rest of that quote from then candidate Trump at that debate last year.
And we have a Fed that's doing political things. This Janet Yellen of the Fed, the Fed is doing political by keeping the interest rates at this level. And believe me, the day Obama goes off and he leaves and he goes out to the golf course for the rest of his life to play golf, when they raise interest rates, you're going to see some very bad things happen.
Two things about that. Number one, flawed as presidential golf metrics are, since he mentioned his predecessor, President Trump has played golf 41 times since Inauguration Day. Number two, Chair Yellen and the Fed have raised interest rates three times since that debate. Ain't nobody talking about Janet Yellen being political. Let me tell you that. All right, the Dow today, as you know, above 22K, 22,016, up 52 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ basically flat, 63.62. The S&P 500 up a point, call that flat as well, 24.77. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.